We may take the wedding trip to help us see the proper sequence of spirit and physical intimacy. Why do the people go away first before they come home? So that it becomes quite obvious to everybody that they are united first and then they enter their home. If you just have a big mansion to inherit or a cardiac in which you can put your girl and commit some acts of sex with immunity or with impunity, that it doesn't make you really belong. Therefore, the wedding trip signifies the fact that you two people belong even without any visible home, even without any visible architectural arrangement for keeping you together. The same is true, of course, of your friend. A friend in need, a friend in agony, is a better friend than a friend established because you meet at a party. The peace of state, the calm, the wedded calm of state, Shakespeare calls this strange fact that we don't go to war despite all the factions and the party system here in the United States. Think of our own country. Think of the peaceful decision in 1776 that a villager in New England and a townsman in Boston from now on should have more to do with each other than the townsman had to do with the British crown or the villager had to do with the British crown. Before, every inhabitant here in the colonies could appeal to Britain for all his rights or all his grievances against any other man. Now, the independence, of course, had to create a new inside, because it meant that although the people in Vermont hated the people in New Hampshire, and they had good reasons to hate them, and they hated the people in New York, still they decided finally to put up with these enmities without going before the King of England or before Parliament in London. And you know, it actually happened just like that. Norwich was separated from Hanover from 1776 to 1791. It belonged to the independent state of Vermont because there were two hates to be reconciled. The hatred against the British crown was only one of the hatreds of the settlers of Vermont. They hated Massachusetts and they considered of joining Canada. The village in which I live, Norwich, voted in 1791 with a majority of votes to join Canada. Only the whole of the state carried the Union. We poor people in Norwich, we were forced into the Union by majority vote of the state. Well, what I'm trying to say, however, is more serious. We don't see our history when we talk of prosaically taking a vote to become the 14th colony. No, the real story is always a story of lovemaking, of marriage, of great passion. Since the people in Vermont felt that the people of New York, or at least the governor of New York, had cheated them, they had to choose between two wars. When they voted to enter the Union, listen well, they entered the Union. Modern semanticists never tire of poking fun at the poverty of language, which causes us to use a simile, as they say, like this one of they enter the Union. They always think, the people in the language departments, that we, with our wonderful minds, are much more intelligent, are much more superior than this poor tool of language. It's the other way around, you may be sure. The abstract thought would perhaps be expressed that I am now number 14 among the colonies. I don't know what this would mean, but could you say more beautifully and more truthfully what happened in 1791 than to say Vermont entered the Union? You really enter, that is, you get inside. Never believe then that language is imperfect and that you are perfect, your mind, your great reason. It is always the other way around, because language becomes perfect whenever we have the courage to speak the real thing. Then we do not use metaphor, we don't use simile, But we certainly create bodies, physically touchable, sensible things, events, which we can then describe like this one of entering the Union. Usually, the college student especially, and the academically educated men won't mention God, for example. That's too risky. Our forefathers proclaimed his glory, but we say, I got it somehow, when the Puritan would have said, I got it by God's providence. When you hear a man today say somehow or anyway, you always know that he tries to avoid mentioning God. So you too are ashamed, all modern men are ashamed, of proclaiming the most secret and most intimate union, which we should maintain with our Maker whenever we speak fully and know that what the Spirit commands us to do must incarnate in some visible form of intimacy, in a pair of lovers, in a pair of friends, in a group of states. Then we will never be deserted by language. Language will always describe the new creation as being visible, as an inside against an outside, as a step forward against sliding backward. Take a simple example which is used today by every man in the street. They say Europe is gone, but some still say England is a great country. Or others say with Spengler, Europe was a great civilization. Well, in any such case, you decide between the past to which you condemn Europe or between the future into which you still call your beloved England. It's still a great country. If I'm looking forward to Europe, then I have to say it is a great civilization. If I have said goodbye to Europe, then I say she's finished. But then it has died in your heart. She's out of the sanctuary. She's thrown on the cemetery. And with this little word, one word, is or was, our speech allows us to make the gravest decisions, to create an inside which still has a future, or to throw out into a past which remains outside of us. If you say, Europe is not a part of my future, you have not to be so explicit. It is enough to say, Europe was great. With this simple sentence, and we can't avoid using such sentences all the time, we express our decision. We say in which universe we live. We distinguish between the living universe and the dead universe. France is rotten. Well, then we have thrown France out of our future, not completely, because something that is rotten may be still revived. But when we said Vermont entered the Union, or when we said for 15 years she stayed outside, we decided where the inside was lying. Anybody who says Vermont entered the Union in 1791 repeats the act of founding the Union together with Vermont. Think of the Confederacy. They said they could secede. They were, South Carolina declared that it stood for nullification. Therefore, the Union had to do something about it. It had to assert that they had to remain inside. By saying then that Vermont has entered the Union in 1791, every child in school should create once more the unity of the 14 states. And it does, by repeating trustingly what the teacher tells him. This little boy in the grammar school does actually regenerate, restore the Union. And when this had been taught for 90 years or for 80 years to the children in school in the United States, the Confederacy could be beaten. Because in the hearts of all these children who had gone to grammar school between 1783, let us say, and 1860, these words spoken by themselves simply as topics of learning, it seems, reverberated and made them recreate the old Union which they had carried in their memory and in their hearts. This much we have to say in connection with shame about the power to speak when people speak really. We impart life or we kill when we open our mouth. Anybody who formulates a full sentence without quibbling, without saying anyway, or I don't know, or perhaps, or in a certain manner, or it is probable, but who really says what he thinks, without tergiversation and subterfuge, we create times and spaces. We always define our inward and our outward, our future and our past. We cannot formulate one sentence of this miraculous process of speaking without giving it a verbal tense, is or was. There's another criterion of every language which shows you this power of inside and out. Whenever you speak to you, to me, of you or of me, you are inside. Whenever you speak of him or her or it, obviously she or he or it are left outside, the intimate group. When a person enters the room and she hears that you have talked of him or her as he or she usually will blush, because her shame is violated. She was talked about or talked of, and she doesn't know what people said because she was treated as absent. Now that is a sacred rule of all good company, which is violated in the United States, as I have experienced time and again, but which in a strange manner is more respected in England. In England, it will never happen that a person that belongs inside, into society, is ever spoken of as really absent. She could enter or he could enter the room any minute, because they treat this person as always with them, always inside. I can only recommend to you a similar behavior at any party. Take a cocktail party, five people talking, John, Jack, Elizabeth, Margaret, and Anne. Well, you better use these names all the time in conversation. Never say, must Jack and John say she of Anne, because you must be prepared that she comes over, offers you a sandwich, and at this very moment, she will not be embarrassed if you say Anne is just going to a party. But she must be embarrassed if you say she is going to a party, and she realizes that that is Anne of whom you are talking. This impoliteness, however, prevails in our natural society very much, where everybody is treated as an objective figure in the zoo or in the desert of nature. But this is a violation of hospitality. No host and hostess can afford to speak of a guest in the third person. To be a guest means to have the right to be addressed directly and always to be considered a member of the party, a member of the family, and membership, therefore, is a life lived in the face and in the presence of others. And that is the difference between membership and statistics. The number 159,000, etc., citizen of Arkansas, is not a member of Arkansas as long as he only carries this number. He's only a member of Arkansas as long as the town clerk has to address him, Mr. John Smith. Now, what is achieved by this shame of membership, of this, by this belonging inside, by this protection, common protection, mutual protection, against any raid from the outside hostile world? The achievement of membership is that we gain time, time to grow. Shame always gives us freedom to change undercover, because certain things to the world outside are now not known. We have time to improve on them, to change them. We can surprise the world. Because if the telescope of the world would be on all of us all the time, if we were watched every second, we would remain paralyzed. Shame gives us the time to leave one way of life and go over to another. Or, put it differently, to distinguish what is final and what is just casual. If we had not this protection by shame, every act of ours would have the same relevance in the eyes of the world, and we could never say, oh, I didn't mean this, but this I mean. Therefore, all our power of relating things relevant and cutting out things irrelevant would cease to function. That is why the confessional of the church is always absolutely sacred. No Catholic priest, even under death penalty, if he is a priest, will give away what he has been told in the confessional. Now, we have no church in Protestantism. We have only single individual Protestants. And we have this on purpose because we do not want to give the Protestant minister such power over another soul. The result is that no Protestant minister ever omits of telling his wife. Therefore, it is very dangerous to mistake the Protestant church for the Catholic church and to go to confession and to confess to a Protestant minister. He hasn't been trained to do this. The reason for the celibacy is just in this, that the Catholic priest has no wife who would have a right to know all his secrets. Let me tell a funny story of my own family of law, of the great faculty of law in Leipzig University to which I belonged when I began to teach. One time in my faculty, the dean had imposed strict secrecy on some news. I've forgotten what it was. I suppose somebody was going to be called from another place, something equally important. Certainly, this is what occurred 3 days after the meeting in the faculty, this secret meeting. This same dean was approached by the wife of a colleague from another faculty on this very matter. He was furious. And he said, now we must find out who the culprit was. Who has given away this deep secret? I'm going to convene the faculty and we are going to expose the men who betrayed our confidence. In his rage, he actually did convene the meeting and he said, I demand from every member of this faculty to get up solemnly and to assure us that he hasn't told the story to anybody. Well, a man at that time was the leading old emeritus who had a wife, Elizabeth, who ruled him with an iron rod. He came to the meeting because in Europe the emeriti take part in all those meetings and they also still give seminars and free lectures, and that is how old age is treated in Europe to the distinction of this country. This senior emeritus then stood up as the first and he lifted his arm and he said, I solemnly declare that I have not. And then he turned aside and said, oh, is it possible that Elizabeth should have told? You see, that finishes my story, if you understand it right. He felt that he had not given away the secret by telling his wife. The only problem on his mind was, had Elizabeth talked? Of course, that was too bad. If she had opened her mouth. But he would have gladly sworn and forsworn himself, although he knew very well that he had told his wife. But that was inside. It couldn't get out of the family. What we gain by shame, then, is space too, an inner space, which we can use to discuss, to converse freely, and it has no consequence. It remains in the bosom of the family. So we gain time and we gain space for irresponsible, playful, preliminary, shall we say, talk. Preliminary is a very fine word because limen means a threshold. And when we talk preliminary things, then we have not gone over the threshold of our home, of our inner man, of the intimate unit, out of which then later the decision goes forth after the preliminary talks, the irresponsible ones, have taken place. If everything then at every corner was known immediately, where there would be no time, outer time would gallop away with us. And you know the great poem in which the English lover tries to persuade his sweetheart to gain time with him. You can't get engaged, you can't single out what is serious and what is play in your own life. If you have to register for every look at a girl, and they immediately say, he seems to like her well. I had a great cousin who in this way got stuck. He had danced too often with a girl. His father-in-law sent word to him that he expected him to marry his daughter. He was such a coward that he did. He was in politics and he feared that it might damage his political career if he didn't obey the orders of this rather influential merchant in town. Well, do you think they got married? I don't think so. It was just that the observations from the outside, you see, forced this man to make his decision. It takes us 4 years in college, after all, before we make up our mind what to do later. And all the people who have already made their decisions are these shameless pre-meds, for example. They are not growing anymore. They have already done their deciding. Now, of course, I'm poking fun at them, but one thing is sure, they are already professionals. They don't have this growing time because they already can be spoken to as pre-med. You, the majority of you, are nondescript. And this title of being a student in Dartmouth is your weapon of self-defense. You hold off the impinging curiosity of the outer world by telling them, I have the right to wait with my decision. I am here for godly 4 years in which to make up my mind.